This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The mourning continues for the victims of last Saturday's shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, where 11 people were killed. The Tree of Life massacre came at the end of a week that also saw pipe bombs mailed to several Democratic Party figures and the fatal shooting of two shoppers at a grocery store in Louisville in what police are calling a racist attack. So how do faith leaders comfort their congregations in the aftermath of an attack that hits so close to home? What does it say about the polarisation of American society at this moment in time, and what's the way forward? We're at 1-866-338-5252, and we're taking your comments and questions on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us in the studio today, we have the three wise guys. We have Rabbi Steve Engel. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here with you, Matthew.
Imam Muhammad Musri, thank you as well, Imam.
Good morning.
And Reverend Byron Fulwider, thank you so much as well.
Thanks for having us.
And you'll hear, of course, the Rabbi, Imam, and Reverend on Tuesday nights on Friends Talking Faith on 90.7. I wanted to invite them onto Intersection, though, for some reflection. It's less than a week since this tragedy happened at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Rabbi, what did you think when you heard about the Saturday? I mean, does this kind of feel personal to you?
Oh, it feels very personal to me as a Jew, because we are all in our tradition, like many traditions, we're all connected to each other as brothers and sisters, literally like family. And so when someone does this, it feels like actually someone did it to a member of my family. Mm-hmm. So it was shocking on the one hand, but it wasn't shocking on the other hand, given the vitriolic cultural discussion and the nature of discussion, political and communal discussions that have happened lately.
There are also some fairly strong ties, I understand, between the Jewish community in Pittsburgh and the Jewish community here in Orlando. The oldest synagogue I was reading was established with the help of members of Pittsburgh's Jewish community. Just how strong are those ties?
Well, there are a lot of people in Orlando who lived in Squirrel Hill a lot. And some of the early members of the Jewish community in the 1930s and 40s, even into the 20s, were actually people who came from that area of Pittsburgh to start a new life here in Central Florida.
Mm-hmm. So that also kind of brings it home. You mentioned the fact that obviously it sort of feels personal anyway, but even more so, I guess, for
even
for
more
Orlando.
So because for me, I've known people. I didn't know any of the victims. I've known people. I grew up in Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh was connected to me through my youth movement and through my synagogue. But there are people here who actually knew some of the victims. And we had a event this week on Tuesday, and there's a person who spoke who actually grew up in that synagogue and was bar mitzvahed in that synagogue. And there are a number of people who grew up and actually went to that synagogue mm-hmm. personally.
And we'll talk more about that event in a minute. I want to talk to you, Reverend Fulwider, though, and bring you into this conversation. This isn't the first time there has been an attack on a house of worship. Sutherland Springs in Texas, the First Baptist Church in November 2017, a lot of people died there. The shooting at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin in 2012. The Dar el-Farouk mosque bombing in Minnesota in 2017. Nobody died in that incident, but nevertheless an attack on a house of worship. And of course, in Quebec last year, six people killed at a mosque shooting there. What do faith leaders tell their congregations when something like this happens?
Yeah, not to mention the attack in Charlotte of the church there. While people were, again, praying, studying scripture, sharing their love and for one another and for the world. That's what's so, I think, shocking about that. What I think we start with, of course, is shared grief and that sense of our, as the rabbi talked about, our connection with each other. We'll talk a bit on the radio program with A.J. Jacobs this week, who also, the author, has a unique connection to the congregation in Pittsburgh. And he says, he teasingly says he's Jewish, much like the Olive Garden is Italian. They have great breadsticks, but anyway.
Is that part of the Jewish tradition, but, breadsticks?
No, it's more like challah and matzah.
There you go. Right. Yeah.
You like challah.
So this connection among every person is such an important part of our message. And then the question, what do we do mm-hmm. beyond thoughts and prayers? Because I think we're all kind of tired of hearing that as a trite phrase. It's important if you really are thinking and really praying. That's a wonderful thing. that's not enough. And I think we need to say to all of our communities, it's time to take action. We're coming up on Tuesday. If you feel that elections can make a difference, you ought to make sure you're out to vote and encourage all your neighbors. If you feel that becoming active in some of the organizations that are working for peace, you ought to do that. There are many ways to get active and involved, but we've got to stop this, as the rabbi talked about Tuesday night, this constant cacophony of hate and violence that's coming to us from leaders all over the country. And we're talking not just political, but religious, business, every area where leadership has a responsibility to speak good words, mm-hmm. and hopeful words.
Imam, we are hearing about how the Islamic community is reaching out in support of the Pittsburgh Jewish community after the shooting, a fundraising effort there for one thing. What's your sense then of what a tragedy like this does to kind of highlight the shared connections between the different faith communities? Is there a sense of solidarity in the face of grief like this?
Absolutely. We feel that an attack on any faith community is an attack on all of us. And as you mentioned in the beginning, there is a history now. Almost every faith community have been touched with violence, and there is apprehension. There is a lot of fear. Today, on Friday, will be the first service since the massacre in Pittsburgh, and we have ratcheted up security, and we are responding to a sense of anxiety and fear in the community. And I'm sure tomorrow into Saturday and Sunday, all faith people will be in that state of fear. And we believe that, you know, when Muslims were attacked before, Jews and Christians came to support our community, and we feel a sense of brotherhood, and we need to be there for each other and to support. And I would say the support here is symbolic. You know, no amount of money is good enough to replace what happened, but it is a message to say we are with you, we support you, we love you, and we are hurting like you are. And that is, we need to stand in solidarity across all faith and no faith, because hate and violence does not have a faith, does not have, you know, they don't care who they are killing, women, children, elderly, you know, 97-year-old, why that person has to go in this violent way. The person who carries out such a crime has no heart. And that is, we need to know that they're not going to discriminate if they were at a mosque, a church, or anywhere else.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're joined with the three wise guys, Rabbi Steve Engel, Imam Muhammad Musri, and Reverend Brian Fulwider, just talking, reflecting a little bit on the tragic events of last Saturday at the synagogue in Squirrel Hill, Pittsburgh. Rabbi, let's talk more then about what happened here in Orlando on Tuesday night, a gathering, a interfaith gathering, I guess you could say, and bringing some of the community in there. Just give me a sense of the purpose of it and how you kind of went forward with that.
I appreciate that. I just did want to say, related to what the imam said, that, you know, when people criticize each other's faiths and people do this, you know, I was so taken back that the Muslim community in Pittsburgh basically raised the money to pay for the funerals of the Jews in Pittsburgh. That says a lot. It's not about the money. It's about the gesture. So those kind of same things we want to happen in Orlando. And on Tuesday night, we, in a very short time, the Greater Orlando Board of Rabbis, in partnership with the Interfaith Council of Central Florida, in partnership with the three of us as the three wise guys, in partnership with over 20 other organizations, put together an event. I didn't want to call it a vigil because it was more than a vigil. It really was, first of all, a memorial service for those who died in that massacre, and for people from Pittsburgh and people just in general, human beings, to come and pay tribute to the memory and as a memorial. And there was crying and there was weeping. And then the second part of the gathering was to really talk about where do we go from here, even though it's early, a call to action. And we put it out relatively quickly and got I think there are, I don't know, estimation of about 1,600, 1,700 plus people who showed up at short notice in the synagogue. We felt it was important. We had offers to have it all over town, but we felt it was important symbolically to have it in a synagogue. And because of obviously the event happened in a synagogue. And so we gathered, there were leaders of every single faith there. People spoke, prayers were read. I spoke about a call to action, which we can talk more about. But it was just really moving. The responses that I received and did receive were just, people felt it was something they really, really needed. And they don't see a lot of that in the community. And I think that it was a message for all of us about how many good people there are out there and how many people have sort of stood on the sidelines for a long time. And I think the message also was back from the people who were there is like, we've had enough. And now we're ready to stand up and really do something about this kind of conversation that's been happening.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking with the three wise guys reflecting on the tragedy in Pittsburgh last Saturday and a call to action. Wondering if you're one of those folks who has been standing on the sidelines, as the rabbi said, for some time and now thinking enough is enough, time for action, and what those thoughts might be. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can also reach out to us on Twitter. We are at WMFE Orlando, taking questions and comments there. Ryan Fullwider, your perspective from, you know, as a Christian, seeing this gathering, this interfaith gathering, what was kind of going through your mind watching this unfold on Tuesday night?
Well, I think a sense of the solemnity of the moment that we had gathered to really stop and remember and give thanks for this group of people who were taken from us. And I think it's important if we say taken from us. It's not that they were lost. They're not lost at all, but they were taken from us by a madman. And so that was a powerful experience to be able to sit together as faith leaders from a huge variety of backgrounds and you know, pretty much all the active rabbis in Central Florida, they're giving leadership, as well as dozens of others from other faith communities who were seated in the congregation, along with numbers of politicians and leadership from other organizations and folks in the community from every breed and stripe, as we'd say. And and it was a powerful moment. But especially because I think, as the rabbi said, there was this clear sense that it's, you know, we've kind of gotten to the end of our rope with this this horrible continuing violence in our culture and society. And, you know, sadly, we hear these voices which really highlight violence again today. I mean, you know, we're hearing this every day from leadership and talking about, you know, if someone throws a rock, we'll shoot them. This is breeding this kind of anger and hatred. I mean, at every level, and we've got to put a stop to it.
How do you reach then? You know, you mentioned before it's not just political leaders; it's also faith leaders in some cases, business leaders.
Leader, right.
How do you reach those people?
Well, I think one of the things we're talking about are these meetings that we're going to hold, in which we're going to really sit down with citizens, and over 1,000 people have shown interest in being part of these meetings, and we expect more will come. We've got 7 around the community, but this isn't just a one-time thing either. This is a beginning. You know, Tuesday night was in a way a beginning of what will happen next, and then beyond that, really beginning a campaign. Part of that is helping people learn how to hold others accountable. So there are many ways you can do that. If it's a business leader, you boycott their business. If it's who's doing this? If it's a political leader, you vote them out. If it's a religious leader, you get rid of them from your denomination and you begin to talk about how you change the culture. And I think that's what we're about in this. So wherever people are doing this, we need to hold them accountable and put a stop to it and shift the conversation of our society. It's okay to have disagreements. We should. It makes us better when we sit down and really talk about how we get things done. But to have disagreements to the point that we're inciting violence and death, that's not going to work to build a civil society going forward. And we're pretty uncivilized in many ways right now.
Imam, what kind of conversations are going on with faith leaders in the Muslim community? I mean, is there more now, just kind of reflecting on what Brian Fulwider is saying, is there more a sense that there needs to be a call to action rather than kind of talking about more sort of lofty ideals of faith? Like, is there are conversations that are happening with, you know, leaders in the faith community, in the Muslim community, more about here's what you can do, whether it's getting out and voting, whether it's doing some of the things that Reverend Fulwider was talking about?
Well, in addition to all what Reverend Fulwider just mentioned, you know, we had meetings this week to revisit our security policies and see what else could be done. Mm-hmm. But we talked about how to build stronger connections with other faith communities, because this cancer in society is reaching to all parts of society, and both religious and secular. We have seen what happened, you know, at Paul's in Vegas, at Parkland. So it's not restricted, and it is primarily the gun culture, the promotion of, you know, by the NRA, with more shootings, we want more guns on the streets, more guns in schools, more guns. You know, the ridiculous statement that, oh, if there were guns in the synagogue on Saturday, this couldn't have happened. I don't expect...
You mean per, like, having armed security at the synagogue?
Yes, but I have visited many synagogues. I always see security. And, you know, there should not be a security at any place of worship. That should be off limits to guns.
But I think there are probably some faith leaders, at least, who might disagree with that. And I see you nodding there, Rabbi.
But I don't expect, you know, a 97-year-old has to be prepared with a gun to go to the synagogue or to a mosque. You know, we go there to worship, not to – we are not on a battlefield. This is America.
But there's a difference between saying to your congregation, you have to come armed, and saying we are going to provide security. And I just want to pick up on that point with you, Rabbi. Do you have some different thoughts on that?
Well, you know, we disagree on the show, and we do it civilly and respectfully related to this. But I think we do have to have security. The problem is that when you have security in a religious institution, it's taking away from programs for kids. It's taking away for – because there's a cost related to it.
Yeah.
But the cost of losing life is much higher. And so,
yeah, it's kind of like the debate over security in schools, right?
Exactly. And, you know, and the imam is right. In an ideal world, we would not need to have guns and have people armed. But we've reached a point, unfortunately, that we have to – in our synagogue, we've had for many years armed security guards. And again, I think also what the imam is saying, to not totally disagree with you, imam, is that there's no indication that just because there would have been a security guard that people wouldn't have been killed.
Sure.
That's not a guarantee. All you're doing is narrowing down your odds that someone will be killed during that time. But it is a sad state that we're trying to be – the balance is very difficult between trying to be a religious institution that's open, because you don't want to be like a – you know, you don't want to be like a guarded prison. You want to be open, but at the same time, in our religious traditions, the saving a life is primary.
Mm-hmm. But,
and so this is very difficult kind of situation. And there are congregations where they have people in the congregation that are actually armed, and the religious leader knows. I've gotten calls of people that said, Rabbi, you should get trained and start carrying a firearm. Hmm. So, you know, these are very difficult times. And the fact that it's even reached this level is just outrageous.
Mm-hmm. My understanding, there were four officers who are trained officers of the law police who were shot. You know, you can't – it's so difficult when you have a permission to carry assault rifles into schools, into, you know, houses of worship. You're going to have these massacres keep happening. Our politicians need to understand that – you know, especially faith leaders mm-hmm. need to understand that the culture of death and killing does not go with the culture of peace and love that we all preach. You know, faith leaders who are concerned about the life of the unborn, and they make, you know, a lot of political waves about it, say, what about the already born who have families, who have loved ones? Don't they deserve equal rights of protection? And how could you advocate for, you know, carrying arms everywhere, and then, you know, at the same time, you want to protect the unborn.
So you've got, there's a sort of a bigger philosophical debate going on here. I want to come back, though, if I could, to sort of what's next. And Rabbi, you sort of mentioned some of the things. If I could maybe pick up on that with you, Reverend Fulwider, what does that call to action look like? And if you're talking about the three wise guys, how you sort of go forward from here, what are you asking from your listeners and I guess from your congregations, too?
Well, I think there's a number of ways that it goes forward. So one is we gather in these meetings and begin to discuss what we can do, what tangibly can be done. And I think that's going to be very important because we'll gather a lot of ideas. We have a lot of ideas. We want to share those. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think in terms of what we do, we're going to continue to do the work we do in calling for building bridges, understanding we're all connected. We're all part of the same human family. That is undeniable in terms of biology and other ways. And third, I think as a country, we have to make a decision that we're going to shift our conversation. We're going to shift our way of being in community with each other. And that means we have to stop demonizing the other, whoever they may be. We have to start seeing the other as a fellow human being, a family member on the journey with us.
Even when they do terrible things?
Well, yes, even then. I mean, that certainly is the Christian perspective, that we do embrace everyone, even those who do terrible things. But we call for transformation and change. We call for a change of heart. And we also work hard to stop people from doing terrible things. We all have a decision. Every single day, every single moment, we've got a decision to make. Are we going to, you know, I mean, the old adage, are we going to feed the good wolf or the bad wolf within? Are we going to decide to do the thing that's good? Because I could act that way, all right? I recognize I have the capacity to do terrible things. I make a choice. We all make a choice every day not to do that. We have to call people to make that choice.
Mm-hmm. And Rabbi, you mentioned before that the sort of theme of this message going forward is that words matter. Of course, as a faith leader, your words are very important, right? I mean, that is kind of the core of what you do. But what is more important about this message now? Like, what's changed?
Well, I think from me, my personal perspective is that as a Jew, I'll speak from my faith perspective, is that Jews have been in this country for a long time, and we in the Jewish community maybe lived with a little bit of a myth that anti-Semitism was kind of over and things were getting better. And then all of a sudden, the worst aspect of anti-Semitism, of hatred, of taking a life, all of a sudden, you know, comes to light again, and mm-hmm. so there's like an eye opening all of a sudden. Oh my goodness!
And if you listen to the Anti-Defamation League, for example, they say, well, that's actually been on the rise.
Right, the increase 37% 2 years ago, and 34%, 57% this year. But I think, Matthew, the message is, you know, when three of us get up to give sermons, we carefully pick every single word because we know that as leaders, we are given the ability. Just as you are, by the way, in the media, you have a power because you're on the radio wave, airwaves, or the media and television. You are given as a media person, the same as I is given as a rabbi and the president on down to the city council person. Everyone who's a leader is given a power of words. You influence people. It's just how it is. You're given that. And yet we've lost the idea that with that power comes responsibility. And it's sort of like, well, I have the power and it doesn't matter the way I use it. No, it does matter. I, as a clergy person, are counted by every word that I say. You, as a news person, are counted by every word that you say. And I have to say, and I'm not picking on you as a personally, but the media seems to project a lot of negative stories. Hmm. And the more negative stories, but where are the positive stories about the good things that people are doing? Those seem to be a little bit lost.
Hmm. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but you can check in with the three wise guys on Friends Talking Faith. They're on next Tuesday. Rabbi Steve Engel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure to be here with
you. Also joined by Reverend Brian Fulwider. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew.
And Imam Muhammad Musri, thank you as well.
Thank you for having us.
Up next, 3 weeks after Hurricane Michael, is Florida forgetting about the victims trying to rebuild in the panhandle? A coalition of nonprofits and business leaders is mobilizing to keep the spotlight on the recovery effort. Intersection is back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. More than 3 weeks ago, Hurricane Michael hit northwest Florida. The estimated cost of the recovery is in the billions, and some advocates are worried that the attention of the media and the public is shifting elsewhere. A coalition led by former Florida lawmakers and including organizations like the Florida Chamber, the League of Cities, and the Florida Press Association has launched a website called rebuild850.org to rally support for the recovery. I spoke to Ron Sachs of Sachs Media, one of the partner organizations, about why he wants to keep the spotlight on the panhandle.
Well, there's a new initiative underway, launched with the announcement by former speakers of the Florida House of Representatives, Alan Benz and Will Weatherford. The project is called Rebuild 850. And 850, for those who don't know, is the area code for that large swath of North and Northwest Florida that extends roughly from Tallahassee all the way to Pensacola. That region got battered very heavily by Hurricane Michael, but not everywhere. So, for example, Panama City Beach is unscathed, but Panama City, east of it, a lot of devastation. Destin, Fort Walton Beach, Pensacola Beach, unaffected, but there's a large swath of probably 10 to 12 counties and dozens of little towns and cities that many Floridians have never visited and maybe never heard of that are devastated or in various stages of long-term need. And we don't want Floridians and other Americans to forget about this region of the state. Every part of Florida is vulnerable to the battering of hurricanes. The part of the state that got hit by Hurricane Michael, which is the third worst storm to hit the U.S., the worst to ever hit this part of Florida, that region is sometimes called the Forgotten Coast because it's not well known. What we want to make sure is that people don't forget the ongoing need in this region of the state that's not urban, it's not heavily populated, but it's got a great need right now. So rebuild850.org is a website and initiative established to keep the focus for fundraising and volunteer time and other resources on this region that needs help.
I'm wondering too, I mean, obviously there's an election just around the corner, so there's clearly, there are a lot of things dividing the attention of the media and folks right now. But, I mean, do you get the sense that once we're through the midterm, there will be more of a spotlight back on the recovery effort up in those affected counties in Northwest Florida?
Obviously, we're not waiting for that. That's why this effort's being launched today instead of after the election. And no matter who your favorite candidate is among your listeners, whether we have a governor-elect named Andrew Gillum or Ron DeSantis, we expect that governor-elect to take a high-profile role in this initiative, Rebuild 850. You know, after Hurricane Andrew in 1992, the state of Florida moved many of its functions down to South Florida to help the recovery there. There were tent cities set up for multi-months. It took probably 2 years for a large restoration. And the geographic area hit by Hurricane Andrew in 92, which at the time was the worst natural disaster to hit the U.S., the focus, because it was a large urban area of Miami-Dade County, never went away. The concern here is that hurricane victims in Northwest Florida don't become political victims, too, because they become forgotten. So we don't want that to happen. That's why these two great statesmen of Florida, Alan Benz and Will Weatherford, joined by all these influential groups, are part of this initiative to keep the focus on those battered areas of Northwest Florida for donations and volunteer time. There are two other emphases of Rebuild 850, and they are to visit. We want people to visit this beautiful region of Panama City Beach, Destin, Fort Walton Beach, Pensacola, because those tourist dollars are needed to keep the economy going in those counties and those regions and communities. And eventually, the fourth message of Rebuild 850 is about investment opportunities in the region for people to invest their own capital to either start a business, expand a business, or do something to help to develop the economy there.
The tourism economy, as you say, is pretty important across the state of Florida and of course, in those areas you mentioned. But there surely needs to be a little bit of time for them to rebuild. I mean, if you look at some of those images of the destruction, probably now might not be the best time to take a tour of the area.
Actually, we're not asking people to tour the damaged areas, but there are areas undamaged. So Mexico Beach, certainly one of the most heavily battered beachfront communities in Northwest Florida, was in large part destroyed. But east of it is Panama City Beach, which is unscathed and is open for business and for visitors for wonderful vacations, very affordable rates. if people stop coming to the beaches that are unaffected because they think they were affected, it's going to hurt the economy even more than this storm did. So we need people to go to rebuild850.org and look at the visit button, look at the damaged communities, and look at those that are still available for great vacations. Frankly, I'm planning to take my wife to an unplanned vacation up in the region just to try and boost the economy. The benefit for us is we love beaches, and we're going to see them. On the way to and from such a trip, people will see some of the damaged communities. We want people to go to this website and keep Northwest Florida in their thoughts, because out of sight, out of mind, it's not a big urban area, so we need to remind folks how important it is that they stay involved and aware, and they open their hearts, their wallets, their volunteer time, and they come visit the region too.
If people don't have money to contribute, you're saying that they could kind of find a way through that site to pitch in and donate some of their time at least?
Yes. In fact, we have a donate button. We have a volunteer button. Both of them will take you to the established Volunteer Florida, who have processes to process people's concern into action to become volunteers. So everything's there on the website, a lot of information, very simple to navigate. That's rebuild850.org. And again, we ask your audience to stay sensitive. If it was Central Florida that got battered by Hurricane Michael, the folks in this region would respond and keep their hearts, wallets, and time open to help. And we want our neighbors all across the state of Florida to keep Northwest Florida in mind.
And, I mean, to that end, there are actually a lot of folks in the volunteer community who, you know, the nonprofit community, who have been pretty active up there in the Panhandle region, kind of working on that recovery effort, right?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are folks who respond from all over the country, whether it's the utility industry or the Red Cross is deeply involved in lots of volunteers being deployed. So we know that we have a caring country and a caring state, but because this is a population-challenged region, as in not high density, we're concerned that the focus is already off Northwest Florida by the news media. And if the news media aren't covering it, then people can't know about it. So thank you for this interview opportunity. The Florida Press Association is a partner in this project so that newspapers across the state can get a bulletin every week that they can share with their readers with the latest information about what's going on in Northwest Florida. And also, we expect to produce a 30-minute television special, and a large focus of it will be on the Rebuild 850 initiative. We'll show what's going on in the region and how people can help, and that will be broadcast on one station in each of Florida's 10 television markets, probably between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Just back to the numbers, if I could, one final question. $4.5 billion is the estimate. That's a ton of money. Is that kind of scary looking at that figure?
Well, it's scary looking, but when you translate the dollar damages into people's homes, schools, businesses, a lot of the infrastructure torn up, not just with utilities and telecommunications, Wi-Fi and so, but people's homes and lives have been disrupted forever. They're never going to go back to the same thing, many of them. So the new normal is learning to deal with this, helping them recover and rebuild and readjust to this new normal. And we're in a period now of very severe hurricane seasons. It only takes one storm like this to forever change a region. If this storm had hit 50 miles closer to Tallahassee, to the east, Tallahassee, this Florida's capital city, would be largely still recovering, whereas we were just without power for 3 to 5 days. Lots of trees down and roads blocked. We're back to normal, but we're not going to forget our neighbors to the west. And we ask all Floridians to keep your focus on this region horribly affected by Hurricane Michael, though there are areas that are perfect and in great shape to visit, as I said, Panama City Beach, Fort Walton Beach, Destin, Pensacola. But there are many towns and cities, dozens, in probably 10 counties that have been horribly affected. So please go to rebuild850.org and get up to date and see what you can do to help.
That's Ron Sachs of Sachs Media talking about the recovery effort in the Panhandle after Hurricane Michael. Still to come, E-Turn joins us with a performance from her new album. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. E-Turn has a new album out. Young World was released by the independent label Fake 4 at the end of September. The Orlando-based hip-hop artist is garnering praise for Young World, her third album, and she's performed with hip-hop legends like KRS-One. Here's a track from the new album. It's called Stumble.
Have you ever figured out what you'd be like in a few years? Why don't you look ahead?
There comes a time when you have to lose control. There comes a time when you have to lose your mind. Walking through your inner hell, chipping at your outer shell, tripped up on your past and fell, and there you dwell. Walking through your inner hell, tripping at your outer shell, tripped up on your past and fell, and there you dwell. Stumble through your inner hell, secrets you will bleed to tell, tripped up on your past and well, there you dwell. Yeah. Say all is lost when you walk out that door. Soul split into all grip on who's been feeding off of what's left. Of the moves, suppressing the source and defying your truth. You ain't trying to see it though. Delusions calling, get the go. Enough is enough, but enough's not enough when you're losing your hold. Time's up in a beast, unbeast, fear, faith, essence, coalesce. Madness intertwined in the growth of the soul. Let the beast manifest in the flesh. Hard to get the respect when you're running from self and you're searching for solace and press. Far from figuring out the fashion in which you can feel free enough to undress. Test, bitter you love that taste. Stack up on fronts, get chased. Quick to fill up with hate in a safely wait, in a fake it state. Why do you love what you hate? Why do you love what you hate? Why do you love what you hate? Why do you love? When you walk out that door, all is lost when you walk out that door.
Etern, welcome back to Intersection.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Tell me a little bit about some of the instrumentation you've got in your songs, because it's quite deep. It's quite complex.
Yeah. So all that stuff was done on a MPC 2000 XL. So it's all sampled instruments, and then just chop it all up. And then, of course, the whole album is produced by Swamberger, mm-hmm. who produced my last two albums. And I keep thinking like, I need to break away and do some stuff with some other producers, but we've just grown together and we have a chemistry that's really well, and his beats are just so dope. So I'm like, honestly, right as I was thinking that, I saw a video from this producer, Illmind. He's a hip-hop producer, and because he's doing like a YouTube channel now and giving advice to up-and-coming artists, and he's like, find a producer to my MCs, to my vocalists, find a producer and grow with that producer. And I was like, oh, cool, I'm on the right track, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, it's all Swanberger on an MPC 2000 XL, chopping up instruments and creating that craziness. I like a lot of dreamy sounds. I like piano and the vibraphone. That was a cool mm-hmm. sound in that last track, or Stumble. But yeah, we just would vibe. Mm-hmm. A lot of it was him vibing off of how I felt that day and creating something off of that.
And it sounds a little bit like you've got some slightly older instruments in there too.
Oh yeah, the santur, that's a Persian instrument, the strings in makeshift. I definitely brought that up and wanted him to, in any song where I'm trying to flash my heritage, my roots are, my dad's from Iran. He came mm-hmm. over here during the revolution. I might have talked about that last time. Anytime I'm trying to flex my roots, I'm like, put some Persian instruments in there, and santur is a really big one for me. I like it a lot.
How about the songwriting process? Has that changed a bit in the space between this album and the previous release?
The thought that pops into my head when you say that is that I, going into this, I was like, I just want to feel free the whole time, you know? Because a lot of times you get caught up in that, especially with having, you know, a record deal, you get caught up in the thought of like, oh, what am I supposed to make? And then I had to keep like reminding myself to get out of that and be like, no, this is, you can't think like that because it stunts your creativity. You got to mm-hmm. just feel free. And the realer the art is, the more people can feel it. And that's what I want to do. So I think I just kept the difference is I kept reminding myself, this is just about making good music and making real music. And that thought process is a little bit different, I think.
Is that a challenge for anybody making a follow-up album? Kind of feel like you've got to have, you have something you now have to live up to, therefore.
Absolutely. And every time I make an album, I'm like, I want it to be better than the last one. So, and now there's a lot riding on this now. It's associated with a bigger underground, you know, that's funny, bigger underground mm-hmm. independent label. People who on that label, I'm like, I look up to. So it was like, it was a lot of pressure, and I had to keep reminding myself, chill mm-hmm. out. There was a lot of pressure, but at the end of the day, I think I did what I was supposed to, and I do think this is my best work to date. So I'm happy for that, and I feel like I'm growing, so I'm happy about that.
So what about touring with it? What are your plans?
So I just got off of tour. I did like a little Southwest run. I had planned on, the album was actually put out a little later than we had planned for. So the tour ran a little differently, but it was awesome. I got to do a couple shows with KRS-One, hip hop legend, in Texas. And then I did a show with some Wu-Tang members in Denver, Colorado. And then I just did some other Colorado dates and did an Albuquerque date, Albuquerque, New Mexico. So that was really cool. And I didn't have the CDs through half of that tour. And then I had the CDs through the last half of it. So the last mm-hmm. half of it, people actually got to kind of get an exclusive buy on the CDs. And then I came back home, and about 10 days later, I had my official album release in Orlando. And then I did like a small Florida run. I did a couple other Florida dates. And at this point, I just need to keep touring with it. Like, that's what it is nowadays for independent artists. You just have to tour and, you know, find your markets, find your people, and who's gonna like what you do, and just keep hitting those spots and giving them some dope stuff. And that's what I'm doing right now. So I think we're in the works of, I can't officially announce like what the tour is gonna be, but gonna be touring with a group that I came up listening to. So in the Southeast, Northwest, I think we're going to do a Northwest, a Southeast run, and then a Europe run mm-hmm. in spring. So I'm excited about that.
KRS-One has been around for quite some time, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. He's like, he came up with like the originators of the founders of hip hop, mm-hmm. you know, Afrika Bambaataa and Melly Mel and all these people. So that was pretty intense. Cool. Actually, that's a cool kind of, there's a cool background story to that is he came out here a few years ago, right before I was supposed to drop my first album, Dark Trust. And it was legit like 4 days before my album release. And he made a cipher at the end of his set. And at the time, all these people were pushing the mic towards me. Everyone's like, no, let the lady go. There's a video on YouTube with it. But all these guys were trying to jump in the cipher and no one would let them go because I was there and they're like, let the lady go. And so I wasn't pushy, but everyone ended up handing the mic to me. So I jumped in there and I spit, and then you just see my manager got a video of it all. And you see KRS-One in the background just like, what is going on right now? Like, so hype. He's like, oh my gosh, his hands over his mouth. And after that, like, the Orlando Weekly posted that up and did like a write up on my album release. And that was just a really cool moment. So there's history there with KRS, right? And he came back at the beginning of this year in Orlando, and there's a song on the album called Nowadays that Swam sampled a little piece of KRS's voice. And I was like, me and my videographer went to the show, and he's like, let's do a video and get him to do a cameo. So we went there, and I was like, I wasn't feeling good that day. And I was like, we're not going to be able to do it, whatever. But he's like, no, let's go and try to make this happen. So we went, and he remembered me. And he's like, I've been trying to get a hold of you. Make sure my wife gets your number or you get her number, whatever. I'm like, what? Okay, cool. So he remembered me from that cipher. And then I was like, can you do a cameo for my video? And I was like, we totally sampled you. He's like, I got you. He kicked everybody out of the green room. And then we went back there, filmed a little cameo of him spitting the part that we actually sampled. And he's in the first video that I dropped off of the album for the song called Nowadays. And it got premiered on Hip Hop DX and all this cool stuff. So it was a really cool moment.
Etern, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And to take us out, a track called What Is It All For?
I wake up early in the morning, feeling rushed and unrested. Understand it's been years, I see my spirit being tested. He tells me to stay positive, I'm quick to get defensive. So I throw on some Deepak, hoping to break the tension. Sanskrit mantras, affirmations, and intention. I'm in and out of hell, but I keep searching for ascension. Deep inhale, exhale, trying to fix my aggression. He's trying to love me through whatever, but I keep on flexing. I'm back to right.
You're listening to Etern and a track called What Is It All For? It's off her new album, Young World. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. Production assistance for this week's show from Danielle Pryor and Juan Gualda. Our full silent drive is underway, so if you appreciate the local reporting, in-depth interviews with newsmakers, community leaders, artists and musicians that you hear on Intersection, help us out with a contribution. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go online to wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.
Look into the sky, asking why I try. What is it all for? What is it all for? I can't sleep again. Insomnia's in its feelings at its peak again. Don't really know how I've been dealing. Meet defeat again. Then routine becomes appealing, but I ain't with it. So I end up just staring at the ceiling. Overworked, overzealous, and a bit too jealous. They can't find a heartbeat, and they don't know how to tell us. Getting back into a corner until I'm a cave dweller. Zoning out, envisioning how I stick up the teller. Yeah, it's true. I'm way past broke, surviving.